This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello, and thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. This week, the shocking news out of the Ukraine that almost 300 people have been killed, ostensibly by pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. 27 Australians have been confirmed dead. We'll hear from Greg Barton, International Director of the Global Terrorism Research Centre, who'll explain how such a tragedy could have occurred. A good news story. Sydney mum and schoolteacher Paula Orbia wins her battle against wicked campers. Paula explains why she decided to take action against the misogynistic slogans and how much it resonated with the community. Gerard Baden-Clay was found guilty of murdering wife Alison this week, revealing a man who lived a double life. We speak to a psychologist with a master's in forensics to learn more about why he might have behaved in that way. For Healthy Living, the CEO of Diabetes Australia wants you to be afraid, why you should know your risk of developing type 2 diabetes, a timely reminder during National Diabetes Week. Mark Hadley reviews the TV singing shows, X Factor and The Voice, why are they so popular? And on the weekend at the Archibald Wynne and Sulman Prizes open, we'll learn about the outdoor sculpture exhibition set to rival Sculpture by the Sea. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. It's only 4 months ago that we were talking about the mysterious disappearance of flight MH370. And now, tragically, another Malaysian Airlines flight has gone down. But this time the facts seem to be at least a little more certain. Greg Barton is the International Director of the Global Terrorism Research Centre at Monash University. Hi, Greg.
Hi, good to speak with you.
Is it quite clear that Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine are responsible for what's happened?
What does seem clear, and this is a case where, unlike 370, the facts have become very clear very quickly, is that the aircraft was hit by a surface-to-air missile and brought down at cruise. Now, it could have been an onboard explosion, but the circumstances suggest it was hit by a missile.
And what's the significance of that, of being shot down by a surface-to-air missile?
Well, we almost never hear of this happening. We hear of concern of terrorists or others getting hold of shoulder-launched missiles. They're called MANPADs. Such missiles, however, whilst very dangerous, are only a real threat when aircraft are taking off or landing. So somebody on the perimeter of an airfield can cause trouble. We've seen it happen in Afghanistan. What appears to have happened is that something like the Russian-made Buk surface-to-air missile system, it's a missile launched off the back of a tractor vehicle the size of a truck, has struck this aircraft at 10 kilometres up in the air. And it's only a few specialist military systems that can do this. We had an incident where an aircraft was brought down off Russia back in 83, involving a similar military-grade weapon system, and that was a tragic set of circumstances. We've had a few other cases. You might recall an Iranian aircraft brought down by a U.S. naval vessel in the Persian Gulf. It takes those specialist systems to bring down aircraft, and those few incidents have involved mistakes or conflict situations. This is the first time we're aware of what appears to be a separatist group getting hold of one of these weapon systems and using it, probably making a mistake about the targeting, but
using it accurately.
Using it accurately. If this supposition is correct, then we know that the Ukrainian forces had these Russian-made Buk tractor vehicle missile launchers in the region. They were using them for defense. We've seen in the past that these pro-Russian separatists in the far east of Ukraine have confronted Ukrainian forces and overrun their positions, on occasion commandeered tanks and armored personnel carriers. And that appears to have been likely the case here, that they commandeered this vehicle, had some level of facility with equipment and were able to use it, but probably got the targeting wrong.
If they've stolen the piece of equipment somehow, then presumably somebody knew that they had it and that they might be able to use it.
Yeah, we're talking about something the size of a truck. It's a very heavy vehicle, and these are very large, half a dozen large missiles on the back of it. So you might miss a shoulder-launched missile. You might not do a proper count of your inventory, not know that one has gone astray, but you wouldn't miss this. Mm. And the incident that led to it being commandeered would certainly have been well-known, and therefore the threat involved would have been well-known. That's yet to come out, but that's something we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, and what would the separatists have been hoping to achieve? Do you think that they might have thought that passenger plane was something else?
Almost certainly. Well, there's been a couple of other incidents recently that have involved surface-to-air missiles. In all cases prior, we think these shoulder-launched missiles, these sort of tubes that you see people firing, not particularly long range, not particularly accurate. One occasion they brought down a large Russian-made transport aircraft, very tragically killing a large number of people as it approached an airfield in the east of Ukraine. On another occasion, they brought down a helicopter. And then just this last few days, they brought down a Ukrainian Air Force jet. But you can sort of understand all of those incidents in the context of the civil war. What's happened with the Malaysian air flight is something completely new, and one would have to assume that there was no advantage in the rebels and every disadvantage of them targeting a civilian aircraft, and they presumably thought they were targeting a Ukrainian military aircraft, possibly bringing in troops and supplies. And so as they've made these other hits in the past, they thought they were doing something that was going to help them. This is actually going to give them a lot of grief.
Well, that's what I was wondering. What's the political fallout likely to be from this then?
The political fallout is likely to be that Russia is going to intervene quite sharply and say, we're very concerned about this. This is likely a Russian-made military system owned by the Ukrainians, and it's an embarrassment all around. They're likely to say, we've long been concerned about these separatists. They may be claiming to be pro-Russian, but we're unhappy with this level of violence. We're not directly involved. Russian special forces were certainly involved in the occupation of Crimea, and they probably played a role in fermenting dissent in the early days in East Ukraine. If that's the case, they were playing with fire, and this thing has now got out of control. Mm. So there's a lot of pressure on Moscow to come in and say, we're horrified. We want to be part of the solution. It's true that reports that the black box, so-called black box data recorders have been recovered and handed over. They've likely been handed over to Russian authorities, so the Russians can very quickly show their bona fides by playing a role in clarifying events.
Okay.
And then I think this will probably lead to them actively intervening to negotiate an end to the civil war situation.
And are the people who actually did this likely to face any justice or any legal consequences?
Almost certainly. The context on the ground is this is quite near the border between Ukraine and Russia, about 50, 60 k's from the border. It's 500 k's east, therefore, of Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. It will not be too hard to figure out who was involved in commandeering that vehicle, if it's indeed a support system, and who was around when it was fired. If it can be demonstrated that they targeted an error through inexperience or whatever, it may be that that plays into prosecutions. But I think we're going to have to see some sort of intervention, first of all, to stop the conflict, and then simultaneously to clarify the circumstances, and then to process what's happened, because it's not the first aircraft that these separatists have brought down. There's been dozens of lives lost through these incidents, but it's the first time a completely uninvolved civilian aircraft has been involved, and that can't go without consequence.
No, it's terrible. Was it known to be a dangerous airspace to be in?
To some extent. If you're flown to Europe, you might recall, you know, from our part of the world, you generally transit over Ukraine. I can recall many occasions looking down, following the flight path and seeing the wheat fields of Ukraine, fairly distinctive flat farming land. In recent months, aircraft have been rerouted around eastern Ukraine, around this particular region. They still fly over western Ukraine, okay, but have tended to avoid eastern Ukraine. But to be fair, never before has a conflict zone on the ground presented this sort of danger in the air. I mean, one thing that follows from this is that flights from our part of the world going to Europe not only tend to cross Ukraine, they also cross Iraq. We tend to fly up the Gulf and then across Iraq, and that's thought to be perfectly safe. This incident may involve a rethinking, because if a group like ISIS got hold of a similar military surface-to-air system, then something could happen over that airspace as well. So I think we're going to have to rethink our whole question of air routes over the conflict zone.
Okay.
But up until now, this wasn't seen to be a pressing threat.
Okay. Well, thank you, Greg, for that. Appreciate your input today.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, it's Greg Barton, the International Director of the Global Terrorism Research Centre at Monash University. Imagine this scenario. You're driving with your 11-year-old daughter when she reads a highly inappropriate slogan plastered all over a camper van. Now, I'm not going to read the slogan, but let's just say it could easily be interpreted as condoning rape. How do you explain that to a child? Should you even have to? Well, Sydney mum Paula Orbea started an online petition addressed to the founder of Wicked Campers after her daughter saw a highly demeaning message on one of their camper vans. Now, I first spoke to Paula 3 days into her campaign when her petition had over 100,000 signatures. I asked Paula to explain what happened.
She was on a trip and she saw the slogan, which is, yes, we won't repeat it, but it pretty much categorised all girls as wanting it, I think is the nicest way of saying it, which is just so dangerous, and on the back of the van. She understood there's a certain word that was there that she understood, so she, when I saw her again after that trip, she I wasn't there. She said to me, I saw the most horrible thing on the back of the van, and I had actually just talked about Wicked Campers on my Facebook blog page and was just so outraged that we went straight to the Advertising Standards Bureau site to lodge a complaint, and as I didn't witness it myself, my daughter stepped up, who's 11, and lodged the complaint under her name.
And so it's not the first time someone's complained against Wicked Campers, is it?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's been years and years of complaints, and the Advertising Standards Bureau have upheld many of those complaints, but unfortunately the CEO of the ASB mentioned the other day that it's been a few years that Wicked Campers has just ignored the suggestion to take things down, so they actually have no power to enforce the taking down of any advertising. They can only suggest that it has crossed ethical codes, uphold complaints, but they actually have no power. So that's actually the really big problem in the whole scheme of things with businesses such as Wicked Campers, but
so
there are other people.
How could we change this? What would be an appropriate way of dealing with this kind of thing then?
Well, this is, I think this is government level. I mean, it's got to be some sort of legislation that fines, or, you know, that there'd be some sort of repercussion for crossing that those boundaries, those ethical boundaries. And that's where it becomes shady, I suppose, is what, when does it constitute to create a fine? But as the ASB all sit around and actually rule that something has crossed an ethical code, you would think that at that point then there's got to be somebody that has should be able to enforce or fine a company for not taking the recommendation of taking it down. There are many that are so crass that they're just perpetuate an impression, especially against women, but they have also been homophobic, racist, and also paint males in a really, you know, sex-obsessed way.
Yeah,
for example, there's a really, there's a really horrible image of a man kind of creepy looking, and it says, "We're here for your daughters." That to me is a dangerous perspective. So is it, you know, does it cross a line? Is it, you know, is it just a joke? I think that's where people, you know, will disagree, agree to disagree.
So why do you think Wicked Campers have been so unresponsive, and how would you like them to respond?
I think they've just gone about business. They've been successful. I think their target audience is backpackers, tourists. People have said that they're cheap, and so they've been successful with it. So they're not going to change the formula because it works for them.
Yeah.
I'd like to see them take it down, just the ones that, you know, they just cross that line. And if we keep perpetuating, I think it's the idea that it perpetuates a perspective that then that becomes normalised. When you start to normalise something, when you just keep washing it over us, then it becomes normalised, and then that's when it gets dangerous.
Yeah.
Women and girls especially.
Okay, well, people are listening and they want to find out more, or they want to sign your petition. What can they do?
Well, actually, yesterday I was inundated with comments on the blog, and I would say 95% of them were already people saying, I've written to TripAdvisor, I've written to, you know, youth hostels, you know, to spread the word that they're a company that has no integrity, really, because that's the word. I think it's integrity that we need to embrace that a bit more. I think it's really easy to be crass, easy to kind of go to that gutter humour, but, you know, have some integrity. But people have been very active, so they could check out the comments on my blog. There have been so many great suggestions on people to write to and things like that.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for filling us in, and good on you for taking a stand. It takes courage because you do cop a lot of flack, but
yes, I have. But actually, I'll be honest, it has been 95%. Complete support.
That was Sydney mum and schoolteacher Paula Orbea speaking about her campaign against Wicked Campers. Well, when we spoke, I don't think either of us could have imagined that petition would be picked up by the Australian Senate that very afternoon. I spoke to Paula again the next day. Well, she was on her recess break at the Sydney school she teaches at. She was still feeling a little dazed after her spectacular and surprising win.
It has been overwhelming and an absolute Just humbled, actually.
Did you know that it was going to go to the Senate?
No, I didn't. But I actually did see that there was an article saying that it was going to the Senate yesterday afternoon, and I was just gobsmacked. And then the fact that the motion was passed was just incredible.
It's especially fantastic given that the Senate hasn't been able to agree about anything lately.
and the fact that Wicked Campus hasn't, been listening to the Advertising Standards Board, and they issued an apology and a commitment to change. And so that all happened about 4 days after I started the campaign.
Did you receive an apology personally from Wicked Campus?
Yes, I did.
What did they say?
I had to reread the first sentence over because it said, we'd just like to compliment you on your poise and intelligence and passion in your campaign against us. And I read that first sentence and I thought, what? I didn't quite, but they were very complimentary actually, and then were issuing a press release on how they were going to comply with what I asked.
So how do you feel about that?
I'm actually in a bit of a daze, to be honest. Just feel like it's surreal, like it's something, because I'm back at school and I'm teaching, and so it feels like life is normal, and on the other hand, this amazing victory has happened. I just don't know if anything like that's happened before with such a strong response from people, and that action has happened on so many levels just from one petition.
It's really quite encouraging for people, I think, that if you see something that might seem like in some ways a small wrong, but that it can be righted and that people can make a difference. Do you think others will draw encouragement from this?
I hope so. Actually, the blog on my blog as the petition was going really set through a sort of a drive in people to me and saying, oh, I've written to such and such a person, I've written to this person, I've all good. Some of them were saying, I'll just get spray cans and go for it. I wasn't condoning that sort of behaviour, but it was really encouraging to see how many people were trying to think of all the different avenues that they could use to try and make their statement heard, really, because that's the thing. I think people were just kind of tired of certain people kind of being able to have that liberty to do as they please. And look, I'm not taking away freedom of speech at all, because I've been afforded that luxury as well by being able to do a petition. But there's got to be a line, and I think it really resonated with people that A, it got crossed, and B, it affected an 11-year-old girl, my daughter. So,
Well, congratulations. Well done.
And the other thing I just wanted to say is that these things are, that's why I named the post From Little Things, Big Things Grow. I think these sort of attitudes, can get bigger, and they may seem small, and I've had some attacks and some threats and things like that, but on the whole, it's been very small compared to the overwhelming support.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for taking some time to have a chat, Paula.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks very much.
The details that have emerged after the murder conviction of Gerard Baden-Clay show the extent of the double life he was leading. Not only was he having a long-term affair, he was also active on adult websites for those looking for a bit extra on the side. He appeared to have the perfect house, the fancy car, but actually his finances were out of control. Sometimes he didn't even pay his business partners. In so many ways, he just wasn't what he appeared to be. Sandy Ray is a psychologist with a master's in forensics and an expertise in the psychology of criminals. Hi, Sandy.
How you going, Katrina?
Yeah, the more we hear about Baden-Clay, the more his double life reveals itself. How does a person get drawn into living such a lie?
Well, I guess what we've really got to look at here is the psychology of such a man. And what's been alluded to in the courts and what the prosecution has actually talked about is having a very narcissistic personality disorder. And so what that really means, he has an inflated sense of self. His own importance is beyond everybody else. He has little regard for other people's feelings. He's exploitive of others. That's become very prominent in the court case, that he would use his mistress for saying, I only wanted her for sex. Then he would change his mind, saying, no, I was committed to the marriage. Then on another occasion, he'd say, no, the marriage was not viable, was trying to get counselling, I want to separate, I want to go to the mistress. So at any opportunity, he would exploit other people's behaviour, other people's value to entitle himself to their feelings and to what they can offer him.
How does someone become such an extreme narcissist like that?
Well, it's a really good question. How do you become, you know, is it a symptom of depression? Is it a symptom of anxiety? Is it because it's a learnt behaviour? And typically we understand it to actually be a learnt behaviour. So somewhere along the line, he's probably had quite a well-fed sense of ego. And somewhere along the line, he's experienced quite a bit of reinforcement, and he's reinforced, reinforced, and reinforced. And so as he's been able to conduct his affairs behind his wife's back, it's been reinforced that this behaviour is acceptable. Oh, okay, I can get away with it. Mm. And he talked about, I think, in the marriage that he regarded it as a sexless marriage, as though that was some sort of a justification for having a mistress on the side. But clearly, it's not just a sex, it's actually more about his ego and his sense of what we call grandiosity. So he has a superb sense of arrogance as well. And because of that arrogance, he'll probably find serving time in jail quite difficult.
And so even so, it's a big step from narcissist to murderer. Is that type of person more likely to kill or to commit a crime?
No, look, there's no correlation with that at all. Just before a violent crime, there's either a really high level of distress and a high level of anger. So he has not disclosed what has gone on just before committing that murder. Was there a big fight? Was she threatening him with certain things? We don't know. So no, to be very clear, there is no correlation between narcissism and murder and committing acts of violence. Narcissism is really about a self-serve, as we all know, sort of just as a layperson, self-serving personality type. So what can I do to enhance my position in the world at the expense of other people?
Can someone like that ever really change? Like, does therapy offer any hope for someone like that to become a more balanced person?
It's a really good question, and the answer is narcissists are one of the most difficult people to treat in therapy because, of course, their world centres around them and they don't perceive that they are using other people inappropriately. So, you know, Baden Clay has gone to prison thinking that he's done the right thing, that it wasn't his fault. He would have all this internal excuses of, she provoked me, it was a sexless marriage, what's a man to do? And they are very resistant to therapeutic intervention.
So what could have diffused a situation like this?
It's like the countless women before her who have been women who are involved in domestic violence or interpersonal violence. You know, it's all very well in hindsight to say, could you have walked away? And that's clearly the message. Would she have been in a position to have walked away financially, emotionally? And this woman, you know, what we're picture was sort of painting is that she was on antidepressants. She was quite depressed. She was probably quite disempowered. She was probably financially dependent on him. So, you know, the ideal would be, of course, take control of the situation and walk away. But we know that's often just not available for women who are in a very oppressive marriage. Mm. He ruled the roost. He was the dominator. He was in control of everything to the point that he completely disempowered her sense of self to make any proactive decisions. Mm. So, you know, the ideal is walk away, but the other is we know from countless women and men in really dysfunctional relationships that it's very difficult to often walk away from an impoverished relationship.
Yeah, it sure is. It's a very, very sad story, but thanks for giving us some insight into his profile.
My pleasure. Thanks, Katrina.
Yeah, that's psychologist Sandy Ray talking about the criminal psychology of Gerard Baden Clay, who has been found guilty for murdering his wife, Alison. Still to come on the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast, the new outdoor sculpture exhibition in Sydney, and Mark Hadley reviews the new season of X Factor. 77% of Australians don't think they're at risk of developing type 2 diabetes in the next few years, but that may not be realistic. There are already 2 million Australians who have pre-diabetes and are at risk of developing the disease. Professor Greg Johnson is the CEO of Diabetes Australia. He joins us for National Diabetes Week. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Now, the common perception of type 2 diabetes is that it's a disease that often affects the overweight and obese. Is that the case?
Well, these are common and well-known risk factors for type 2 diabetes. And this campaign, really, our new campaign for National Diabetes Week, you think this is scary, is a provocative campaign that uses images of sharks and spiders and even circus clown as images of things that often do provoke fear in people, that they might think that's something that's scary and that it might change their behaviour or they think about. And we want more people to think about their risk of getting type 2 diabetes. There are many risk factors for getting type 2 diabetes, but it is fairly easy to assess your risk, and you don't need to do a complex blood test. There is an online questionnaire, the Australian Type 2 Diabetes Risk Test, that anyone can do to simply assess their risk with a set of questions. And that looks at all the risk factors for developing type 2 diabetes. And if you get a high score in that set of questions, then you are at high risk, or maybe at high risk, and you really should act to reduce your risk and try to prevent the development of type 2 diabetes, because we have good evidence now developed over the last decade or so that if we do identify people at high risk, we can actually do a lot to help prevent the development of type 2 diabetes.
Okay, well, what's the most effective way that a person can actually lower their risk of developing type 2 diabetes? What are some things they can do?
Well, a number of things. Often it's changing your diet to a healthier diet, and these are all independent things. It's not you don't have to do everything, and every little bit helps. But a healthier diet, because the vast majority of Australians eat too much fat, too much sugar, too much salt, and too much processed food. Secondly, getting more physical activity. Most Australian adults don't get enough physical activity. We're too sedentary. We sit too much. We watch too much television. We sit too much at work. Thirdly, most people need to lose a little bit of weight. And this is not about people who might think about fat people or obese people. We're talking about the weight gain that's happening across almost the entire population, where we see young adults and even our adolescents and children, where we know there are high levels of overweightness or weight gain in our kids, adolescents and young people. So most people need to reverse that, either stop gaining weight or lose a bit of weight. So there's a number of very practical things that people can do to help reduce their risk of getting type 2 diabetes.
It seems like it's the same things that we're being told for everything. I could speak to so many different people from so many different organisations and say, healthier diet, more physical activity, lose weight. Why are we finding it so hard to do it then?
Well, this campaign explores that a bit. It's really about how we think about that. And a lot, what we see in our research is a lot of people think it's someone else who's at risk. It's not them. It's someone else who perhaps is overweight. It's someone else who falls into that category. So a lot of people self-exempt from this, and they don't think it's about them. They think it's about someone else. Or they put it off, and they think, yes, I understand that, but I'll do that next year, I'll do that next month, I'll do that next week. This campaign's about saying, no, this is a real risk, a real threat to your health. It's not something that's about another person. It is maybe about you, and it's not something you should put off. It's something you should do. It's really about the motivations and the way people think about this, and it's also about how the community supports that. It's not all about the individual. It's about how our workplaces, employers, governments, community leaders and everyone does more to help support people to actually take these actions.
Yeah, that's a really good point. All right, well, thank you for your time this morning.
And can I just say, you know, if people can go to the new campaign website, checkmyrisk.org.au, lots of information there.
Okay, thank you. That's Professor Greg Johnson. He's the CEO of Diabetes Australia. It is National Diabetes Week this week. To check your risk, visit checkmyrisk.org.au. Next week is the grand final of The Voice. And just as one singing show wraps up, well, another takes over. X Factor kicked off this week. I'm joined by our TV reviewer, Mark Hadley. G'day, Mark.
Hey, how you going?
X Factor, The Voice Kids. I mean, do we really need another singing show?
Yeah, I think that's a question a lot of people will be asking until they tune in. Now, look, I am a sucker. I know I'm a sucker because I actually tuned in to watch my preview copies of The X Factor. I was sitting up ready to go, thinking, oh, just get this out of the way. You know you've got to do this. You know you've got to do it. And then I watch it, and I'm just hooked.
Yeah, it's funny because I haven't had that experience with X Factor, but I have with The Voice. And the thing is, I would never normally choose to watch it, but we watch it as a family. And there's something about the emotional experience of that you're sharing it together and with the rest of the country that becomes, addictive or something.
Yeah, there is this moment, like, you know, when we get into it, from the very first performance, you're really hoping for something. You're hoping that you're going to discover something that's just, you know, not out there, not noted, you know, and that's the really sort of amazing part. Now, I'm glad for one that these talent shows have turned away from the fairly abusive line that, like, Idol used to go down, which was just, you know, half the fun, quote unquote, was to basically destroy another person on the screen for our entertainment.
Yes.
But they do show a bit of the fact that they've got to sift through a lot of people and they move through that sort of stuff quickly. But then they show you what they have found. You know, you become evangelists for the things that you love. And I think that when you sort of watch some of the performances on The X Factor and you come out the next day and you talk to people, you're an evangelist for this talent. Look, there are some people there who are running the career track. Okay, so you know that they're hoping for a musical career. But that can't explain the dozens of other people who just stand up on that stage and want to be known.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, in spite of that aspect of people saying that they're there to fulfill their lifelong dream or whatever, the evidence is overwhelming that most of them, the contestants, you know, even the ones who win, actually won't go on to have a career in the music industry. So why are they lining up out the door to get on these shows?
Episode one, Regan Derry. I don't know if you remember the band Scarlet Bell, but like it was a girls band, our girl band, and Regan was one of the women in that. Now, she had a successful career as part of a girl band. They were doing well in the United States, and then she left that. And the reason why she left that, and she says this to the program, I kind of feel like I've always had this hidden voice that people never got to hear, and it would mean so much more to me if I could actually just show people and let them hear who I've been this whole time. And I feel like that is what you see. Everything from the first three episodes have been full of jilted fiancés and electrician tradies in Tasmania, and you know the classic sort of hard luck stories, like kids raised by just only their grandmother and no one else to care for them and things like that. And your heart goes out. But what these people then display on the stage is something that is just akin to a masterpiece. And it is very much like walking into a room, you know, where there's some marvelous piece of artwork. Your breath is taken away. Better than that, it's like walking behind like a restaurant or a row of restaurants in a city in a garbage alley, you know, festooned with junk, and then seeing the same masterwork. You don't just say, that's just fantastic. Like I said, you become a bit of an evangelist for it. You want to tell everybody else about it. And more than that, you start looking for the artist. Now, when you really see something beautiful, the response is not to say, wow, that just came together randomly, but rather this is a product of so many things that have come together, and this somebody's hand is behind this, even in the sad stories that they tell. I'm not saying everybody has talent, neither am I saying that only people who are talented are wonderful or beautiful. But what I'm trying to say is that there are these really shiny presentations that occur in our life, these little artistic moments, these masterpieces. And you stumble across them in The X Factor of all places. It's a commercialized television show, and yet what we come back for is to see these marvelous moments. And when we see them, we really should ask ourselves, how did this come about? Not, wow, that's good, and move on to the next one.
You know, I've heard it said that the reason people are hunger for fame is that they haven't received love in their life.
And
when you hear of people who've had a really hard time, and then they, you know, like they've been jilted at the altar, or they've been brought up with no one to love them, I do wonder, are they seeking fame as a replacement for love?
Well, I think it goes even deeper than that, because I actually don't think some of them are even seeking fame. I think they're asking for someone to say they're valuable. And some people, I think, will even walk off the show having had the experience of somebody, of people cheering for them, and might feel good about that.
Yeah, sure.
But there are other people who will go through the same process and will try and fill the hole, you know, with, as you say, fame or that recognition or that sense of value, and find out it's quite empty. And so we see them again 2 years later on the same program. Mm. It didn't work last time, now I'm going to try it again. And that, to me, is the saddest story and maybe the cautionary tale behind all of this.
Okay, thank you, Mark. That's our TV reviewer, Mark Hadley. We've been talking about The X Factor, which launched on Channel 7 this week. So many Sydneysiders enjoy the spectacle of sculpture by the sea. Being outside in the fresh air is just a wonderful way to enjoy an art exhibition. Well, now Woolwich has its own version with Harbour Sculpture. Set amongst the beautiful parklands of Clarks Point Reserve and Woolwich Docks, Harbour Sculpture is just as enticing as its Bondi equivalent, but without the big crowds. Beck Ho is part of the volunteer committee that organised the event. G'day, Beck.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. This has only been going for a couple of years, hasn't it? Where did the idea come from?
It came from a couple of local women who really wanted to bring art to the community.
Now, you had 20,000 people through this last year, which is no mean feat, and it's run entirely by volunteers. A big job.
Yes, it's a long project. Pretty much as soon as the last sculptures were removed last year, we were starting planning for this year. So,
now tell us a little bit about what people can expect to see. Can you just give us an insight into just some of the works that are going to be on display?
Yeah. Last night we actually had the awards ceremony, so it's pretty exciting. We've got some really amazing and controversial pieces from things that are speaking to the asylum seekers, down to cute little of pixies and fairies. We've got some really great pieces out on the point, looking out over the harbour, fishing net style pieces, and something for everyone.
Yeah, I know that I took my kids through it last year and they just loved it. You know, there's always something that they can relate to and that they can connect with. Do you think that'll be the case again this year?
I think that is going to be more than the case this year. This year's art is even more accessible to everyone of all ages. It's art is open to interpretation and it's not just for certain people, and this is why we are so passionate about putting on a public art exhibition with no cost. Mm. It's about making sure that art is accessible to everybody, and I think the kids, they get a real passion from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the community launch party on Saturday night? What's going to happen there?
You're speaking to my heart. It's my favourite part. On Saturday is usually the busiest day of the exhibition. It's the first day of the weekend when we're open. From about 4 o'clock, we'll have a whole heap of food trucks down there to feed you up beautiful foods, and we'll be lighting a massive big bonfire looking out over the harbour, thanks to the SES who are coming down to run it for us.
Yeah, that's great.
And at about 6 o'clock, we're going to have a massive fireworks display thanks to Howard & Sons, who is our sponsor and does a lot of the work on the Harbour Bridge and through Sydney Harbour.
Now, I'm glad you've let people know that the fireworks are on early, because generally we assume they're going to be right at the end, and I'm worried that people will miss them. So.
Me too, but we did it at the beginning because we felt that a lot of the time kids miss out on it, and it is such a great little community event. We haven't publicised it too much because we don't want to be overrun with people. We don't want a vivid kind of experience.
Yeah.
We want to see a few thousand people having fun looking at art. So, yeah, we do the fireworks a little bit earlier, and I think that helps to get families with smaller kids down there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, look, we'll keep it secret.
Just for you guys. It's a scoop.
Okay. Thanks, Beck. I hope it goes fantastically well. A great weekend for art in Sydney with Harbour Sculpture opening and the Archibalds and the Wynn and the Sawmill opening as well. So you could just immerse yourself in art all weekend.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's Beck Ho from the Harbour Sculpture Committee. You can find out more at harboursculpture.com.au or find them on Facebook.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.